Hey there, welcome back to the Ebb and Flow Birth Show. Today's episode is one that I have been so excited for. It is an interview with the doula that I had for my VBAC. Her name is Julie, and she has been a doula for 20 plus years. She's attended over 500 births. And in this episode, we talk a lot about her experience as a doula from beginning to now. We talk a lot about VBAC because she specializes in VBAC. And then we go a little bit into breastfeeding, induction, her tips for VBAC, her tips for new doulas, all of that. It's such a jam-packed episode full of great content. So I'm very excited for you guys to listen and let's dive on in. Welcome to the podcast where we get into the real and raw of pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. My name is Hannah Gill. I'm a VBAC mom, doula, and birth educator. And I help women discover their options and harness their inner power to have the experiences they desire. I'm here to support you through the ebbs and flows of these transformative years so we can have open and honest conversations about the hard, the messy, and the beautiful parts of motherhood. This is the Ebb and Flow Birth Show. All right. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being on.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to talk about birth anytime.
So we have several questions that we're going to go through, and we'll kind of go back and forth about all the topics. But I want to start out with, so why did you get started with birth work, and what has kept you in it all of these years? Because you've been a doula for quite some time now.
I have. I really think I was destined to do birth work. And even when I was a little kid, I used to sit with my animals when they would have a litter, my cats, my dogs, and I would feel their belly. I would feel their contractions. I would watch what they did. And I was just naturally interested in it. Back in the day, when my mom gave me the book, to read about sex education and all that, I read it. I pored over it over and over and over and over because I wanted to understand it all. I always wanted to have babies. Since I was probably 12, I was thinking about having babies and naming babies and all those exciting things. And I was just really drawn to it. When I was in junior high, when we start thinking about our career, I thought I wanted to be an OB. And I got really excited about that for a little while. And then two things happened. Number one is I didn't love science. And number two was I met my husband when I was really young. And at that point, I thought, I don't want to go to school for another 12 years to become a doctor and put off the rest of my life. I want to get married. I want to have kids. And so I kind of gave up on that dream. But then I got married young. I was 18. I had my first one when I was 19. And I was thrilled to death. On my first anniversary, I had a 6-week-old. So that was exactly my plan. And so I had four babies. I had them 2 years apart. I was super excited about that. It's just what I wanted. And but I had different kinds of births. My first birth was really medicalized. Everything I didn't want except a C-section. I mean, just everything short of a C-section. I had preeclampsia. I had gestational diabetes. I spent a week in the hospital before I had a baby. It was just not what I wanted at all. I was induced. I was threatened if I didn't have a C-section, if I didn't have an epidural, I was going to have a C-section. And it was not what I wanted. And so for my next birth, I made changes. I went to a different hospital. I went to a family practice doctor, which at the time was the most, natural kind of doctor you could have in the 80s. And I had a different experience. The hospital I went to actually didn't even do epidurals because they didn't have 24/7
Wow.
anesthesia. So I knew I wouldn't have one. And I didn't like the epidural, and I had a backache for a long time. And so I knew I didn't want that. And so my next birth was pretty good. I had some morphine during my labor, so I forgot my birth. Morphine takes your memory, and because I had some high blood pressure. during the labor. So I was really sad that I didn't have my memory of that birth, and I still don't. And then my next birth was like my beautiful birth. It was my shortest, my easiest. One of the nurses was had trained as a doula, and I didn't even know what a doula was at that point, but she was a very experienced labor and delivery nurse. And she said, "Oh, honey, you want a natural birth? I'm here for you. I'll help you." She helped me breathe. She helped me relax. It was amazing. And in fact, I didn't even push. The baby came out while the doctor was across the room putting his gloves on. So that was just lovely. And it was still like 10 hours, but for me, it was a short birth. But unfortunately, my fourth birth was my hardest. And I didn't know it at the time, but my baby was face up or OP, and he stayed that way persistently. I had terrible varicose veins, and I had to have the support hose that you put on in the morning and take off at the night. And I had to stay off my feet. And so because I had to stay off my feet and I had a 2, 4, and 6-year-old, you can imagine how easy that was. But it was Christmas too. So I was up with my like lounging in a lounge chair every day, which we know as doulas, that's like the worst position you can be in because the baby was persistently OP and he stayed that way. So I had prodromal labor for about 2 weeks every single day around Christmas. And then finally, when I went into labor, it was 24 hours long and I pushed for 2 hours. This is not fair. And I didn't have any pain medicine, but I tell you what, I was screaming. I was one of the screaming, laboring people to the point where my husband said, "Stop screaming." And I think I screamed more. But it was at that point, nobody was really helping me. He didn't know how to help me because, birth hadn't been like that before. And I obviously didn't have a doula. I didn't have any nurses giving me any attention because it was my fourth baby and they thought I knew what I was doing. And I think there were some emergencies that day in the hospital. So I was pretty much alone. And at the time, this was 1987, even with a natural birth, you labored on your back in the bed. I couldn't get up to go to the bathroom. I had to use a bedpan.
Oh my gosh.
And so obviously that's the worst thing to do with an OP baby. I didn't know any different until the baby came out and he was face up. And my doctor said, "Oh, your baby's sunny side up. Look at that." I didn't know what it meant. He told me, he said, "If this was your first baby, you probably wouldn't even have been able to push him out." So anyway, I knew I wanted to help women, but because I had had so much help in that third birth and I knew what it could be like, and this one so much wasn't that. So, but then I had four kids, so. I could only do so much. So I breastfed forever. I became a breastfeeding advocate. And in that, I started to work with the WIC program in my county in 1990 as a breastfeeding peer counselor. And I was very committed to breastfeeding. And it was a hard sell in the WIC program at that time because WIC was a formula. They gave away formula to women. And when they started to promote breastfeeding, it was hard because most women that came to WIC weren't planning to breastfeed. But we made some progress over the 7 years I was there and got the breastfeeding rates up to about 70% initiation, which was fabulous. But I started to see, this was during the 90s, that women's breastfeeding was really getting sabotaged in the hospital. There were no lactation consultants in the hospital then. There was no one there to help them unless they just happened to have a nurse that knew what she was doing. And so I wanted to be there like after they have their baby to help them and give them good information. And then I wanted to like be there when they were in labor. And I had the chance down the road to be with a friend in labor. That was in 1996. And then one of my WIC clients in labor a little bit after that. And I just, as soon as I did it, I just realized, oh my gosh, I love this. But it was still about 6 or 8 years, and I was just attending a few births a year, kind of as a hobby, which, is a really strange hobby. But I had another business, and I had teenagers at home, and like I couldn't do this all the time. But my kids were starting to leave home, And I realized I really needed something for me, and I needed something to focus on. And so then my first grandchild was going to be born in 2004. So I decided to go through doula training. I'd attended about 10 births at that point, and I went through doula training in 2004, and then I started my business from there.
Okay, so how many years have you been like officially a doula and then like attending births in general?
Well, so this is my 20th year
Okay.
as an official doula. And so that's super exciting. I just did all my stats, so I'm excited to be able to have those today. And I've attended 545 births.
Wow.
My goal was to have at least 500, so I've passed that up, and I'm happy about that.
That's amazing. That is amazing. So when you started out after your doula training and you started attending births regularly, what did the beginning of your journey look like as far as supporting births, like compared to how it is now? Because I know you said it was, you had to have that balance between like motherhood and attending births. So what did it look like starting out and then from there on?
Well, a lot of what looked different was that doulas were really unknown at that time. And there were only just a few in the Indianapolis area. I had trained with a doula in Indy that had been around for a while. She had been a labor and delivery nurse for many, many years, and she did my training, and she was a doula. And so we ended up partnering together because we really meshed when I did my training. And so that was just a godsend for me because she gave me all kinds of business
Okay.
and I backed her up. I attended some births with her. I relieved her sometimes when she needed somebody. And just being able to attend births with her and watch what she did, because you can learn, from a book or a video or podcast or whatever so much, but really being there and watching it makes all the difference in the world. So it really made a lot of difference for me. But doulas were really, really unknown. And so the pool of doulas was small, but the pool of people that wanted doulas was really small too.
Right.
And so one of the opportunities I got at the beginning was I trained with Dona for my certification. And one of the requirements was to attend a childbirth class. And my daughter-in-law was attending childbirth class, and so I just contacted the teacher, Lamaze teacher, and said, "Hey, can I just come with my kids because I need to do this?" And we ended up being friends, and we're still friends, the teacher and I. But after I attended the class, before the last class, she said, "Hey, you can get up and talk about doulas and offer to be a doula for anybody if you want to."
Oh,
And
wow.
yeah, and so my decision at the time was to for my certifying births, I was offering those for free until I got all the births I needed for certifying. And I felt like that would help me get it done the fastest and get me more experience. So I offered that in that childbirth class, and I got two births from there, and then my daughter-in-law's birth. So that was three to start with. So pretty soon, I had what I needed, and it was less than a year before I was able to get certified.
Nice. Yeah. It's always nice to have those like to network and find all those the right people in the right places.
Right. Because again, it was hard to get the word out. People still do think doulas and midwives are synonymous. But at that point, they really did. They were like, "Oh, you go to home births?" Like, "Well, I can, but I'm not a midwife." I've
Right.
said that so many times. I don't do the medical part of birth. I'm there for the support.
Yeah, I feel like people, there's still a lot of people that don't know what a doula is now, and still think that midwives and doulas are the same thing. So, and that doulas are only for home births and they can't support in the hospital. So I feel like even now, so many years later, there's still that misconception.
There still is, but oh my goodness, doulas are known so much more. You just can't even imagine it. We're in the daily, the Hollywood scene, and people
Yes.
talk about their doula. There's a radio program I listen to, and the guy and his wife just had a baby, and he was talking on the radio about his doula and how wonderful she was. And I
Yep.
want to find out who she is because I don't know her. But
So,
anyway.
do you want to go over your birth stats a little bit? Do you have the numbers besides just how many you've attended, or do you have some other information to share as well?
I have tons of numbers. For people that like numbers, I think you do like
I do.
numbers.
Yes, I do.
I am so happy that I kept statistics from the beginning, and it wasn't the very beginning, but early enough that I could remember everything. Within the first couple of years, I started a list with numbers, and I keep the list up to this day so that I can keep statistics. And I don't know what made me think of doing that at the time, but like I go back and pat myself on the back, for the forethought to do that, because I'm so happy that I can have it. So over the whole course of the births I've attended since 1996, 67% have been natural births. So I by that I just mean without an epidural. So 67% is pretty good. The epidural rate in hospitals is about 90 to 95%. I don't know if you've heard a different number, but and that can be different for different hospitals.
Yeah.
My C-section rate overall is 19%, which is still way higher than I would like it to be. But the statistics on doulas say that doulas reduce C-section rate by about 40%. And I did the math today because the national percentage right now, the newest number is 32.1% C-section rate nationally. And 60% of that is 19%.
Okay,
So
so
it
yeah, that sounds about right.
right on. So I'm really happy about that number, but I still wish it was lower. I have specialized in VBAC, and that's just kind of grown over time, which I can talk about too. I've attended 114 VBACs, which is 21% of my
Okay.
overall births. So right now, the number of women who can attempt a VBAC is about somewhere between 13 and 14% is what I found. I don't know if you've seen a different number or not nationally. About 13 to 14% of women attempt a VBAC, and so about 21% of my births are VBAC, so are attempting a VBAC. So I'm pretty happy about that number, and 71% of those are successful.
That's really good, yeah.
Most of the national statistics say 60 to 80% of women who attempt to be VBAC will be successful, and my number falls right in the middle of that. So I feel pretty good about that too. So of those that had a successful VBAC, 68% of them, it was a natural birth
Okay.
and the rest had an epidural. So, but that number is still about the same as my overall natural birth rate.
Right.
So I don't know if that means anything, but I have kept track of that over the years.
Yeah.
I've had seven VBACs after two C-sections.
Okay.
I've had one attempt at a VBAC after four C-sections, but she had too much scar tissue and she just didn't progress. But she did have a complete attempt with support. And then I had one client that had a VBAC after five C-sections and was successful.
Oh my gosh, what hospital was this at?
Well, it was at St. Vincent Carmel. It was
Okay.
a while ago, 10 or 12 years ago.
Okay.
And it was totally a fluke that the doctor would even consider it. She was planning a home birth. The home birth midwife, someone who's not in practice anymore, dropped her at 36 weeks. It was horrible.
Oh my gosh.
And so I personally called this doctor and asked her if she would at least talk to her. She did. But the client already knew the doctor, so it helped.
Yeah, that helps too. But still, I mean, after five C-sections, that's very rare for any doctor to even like
And she was
attempt to
advanced
support that.
maternal age. It was like fifth or sixth pregnancy. And the doctor just said, you have to go into labor on your own.
Yeah.
That we're just not going to induce, but you
Right.
have to go into labor on your own. And she did. And she had I don't remember exactly, but it was like a 5 or 6 hour labor, like a short labor.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It really
Wow.
was.
That's really cool. That is really, that's a cool birth to have attended and supported too. Like, that is really neat, a story to have.
It is a neat story. Yeah, let's see other statistics. I've had one vaginal breech birth in the hospital over all that time. Four sets of twins.
Ooh.
I've had one set where both were C-section, one set where both were natural birth, and two sets where the first one was a natural birth, the second was a C-section.
I've heard that quite a bit.
Yeah, not ideal, but
No.
I've had one mother and daughter. I had the mother with her birth and the daughter, not the baby whose birth I was at, but her an older daughter. I've had one second generation birth where I was at her birth and she had her baby in December and I was able to be at her birth. So that was exciting. I've had three sets of two sisters, and I've got one right now where I'm going to be the doula for the third sister.
Okay.
Sisters. That's kind of cool. For two clients, I've had five births in one family.
That's
That's the
really
most.
neat. That's really neat.
I've been to 30 different hospitals or birth centers. I've had 31 home births, which is 5.6% of the total. And that's right about in the line of what we hear is the home birth rate is somewhere between 2 and 5% is what I hear. My first home birth was an HVAC, a home birth after a C-section, but I
That's
didn't know
really
what a
neat
big deal
too.
it was at the
Yeah.
time. I've had three infant demises, so it's not always fun, you know. One baby was preterm and too young to make it. One had chromosomal abnormalities, so we knew that she was going to pass away, but we got to document her life for the 2 hours that she had it. And one was from a uterine rupture outside of the hospital.
And I remember you told me a little bit about that one too. So that was a VBAC client, right?
Right. I've seen two uterine ruptures, one outside of the hospital setting, which resulted in the infant demise, and then one recently was in the hospital. And mom rushed into a C-section. Baby was not in good shape, but survived. Spent some time in the NICU, survived, and is doing well today. Mom survived and is doing well, but it's rough. Those are rough things.
So you've obviously supported a lot of VBAC clients, and what got you into wanting to support so many VBAC? So why is that something you specialize in a little bit?
I was just thinking about that today when I was getting some statistics together to think about what really led me that direction. And my first birth I attended was a C-section. Wasn't supposed to be. It was a long labor, baby wouldn't come out, it was a C-section. So I think from the get-go, I was already thinking about why?
Right.
The fourth birth I attended was that same mom who had a VBAC attempt. And again, it was a C-section. I was like, why? I just didn't know enough. She had a good opportunity, but just didn't happen. The sixth birth I attended was a successful VBAC after two C-sections. Again, at that point, it was 2000. I did not know what a big deal that was, just because I didn't have the experience yet. But it was a friend, and she was just thrilled to have had a vaginal birth. It was exciting. And I think that got me excited. I remember, even though it's been what, 23 years ago, I remember her face when she had the
Well, she
baby,
did it.
picked the baby up. I did it. I did it. I did it. And that so many VBAC women, I hear the same thing. But to hear it the first time, I realized how much it mattered to her to have that vaginal birth. And unfortunately, that same friend, she had two C-sections, then she had the VBAC, then she had two more babies, but she didn't ask me to be her doula, and she ended up with two more C-sections because she didn't have the support. And the fifth C-section, she lost her uterus, had a
Oh,
hysterectomy.
Yeah, and that some people don't realize that the more C-sections you have, the higher that risk of hysterectomy goes up too.
And I didn't really know that at that point either. And I felt so saddened by that, you know, that because even though she had five boys, she still would have had more children if she'd had the possibility of it. So that made me really sad. So then that first home birth I attended was an HVAC. And that really, and I knew the woman. I had been with her for her C-section. And so when she had the VBAC at home, it was just thrills all around. And so I really got involved with figuring out how to help women avoid that first C-section, first of all, and how to help women to have a VBAC. And so my education was mostly just by experience, you know.
Right, which is
And
the best type of education you can really get is hands-on experience.
on experience and learning. And then my doula partner, Paula, she was very knowledgeable. She had had a home VBAC
Okay, see,
long time ago.
yeah.
And so her story inspired me, and she really inspired me to, you know, to keep learning about it. So I think that's kind of where it went for me. And I don't know if you know kind of the history, but in the 80s, VBAC was really pushed and encouraged. And everybody was, you know, like pushed to have a vaginal birth. And a lot of that was insurance driven to keep the cost down. But what they started doing was a lot of induction and using cervical ripening agents, which we know now really raise the risk too much. And so they had a lot more rupture, a lot more problems with labor. And so in the 90s, then it really slowed down and they were a lot more cautious about that. And it really turned around completely at that point to the 2000s, where it was just, you know, almost back to once a C-section, always a C-section. So we kind of now we're coming back from that. And, you know, you and I both listened to the VBAC link. And honestly, I think that is one of the things that is making some of the biggest difference out there. Because of the information that's getting out there.
Yeah, and that's because podcasts are so widely listened to. That was the primary podcast I listened to when preparing for my VBAC too. So yeah, that's such a great way to spread awareness about VBAC because, like you said, the women that attempt to VBAC, it's only about 13%. There's probably more that qualify for a VBAC. They just don't attempt it. So being able to spread that awareness for VBAC, but also for preventing that primary C-section, so a VBAC's not even necessary, is the
Absolutely.
goal. So what would you say that your top tips from your experience as supporting VBAC clients for having a successful VBAC?
Well, that's an easy question for me because I have five tips that I share with everybody who wants a VBAC. And I think from my experience and what I've done, I think they make the most difference. And the first one is to want it. I think you have to desire it. Because it takes a little bit more work, it takes a little bit more proactivity. Sometimes you have to do more. Sometimes you have to work harder to find, you know, find the right support team and all of that. And so I think just really wanting it is the number one thing. You have to help the people around you want it too. You know, your partner needs to really want it, you know, with you. Because if they're skeptical or even negative, it's really going to affect you know, you. The second thing is that your caregiver and your birthplace are so important. So choose that wisely. And what research has shown is it's not your caregiver, but the place you give birth is the biggest reason why you have a vaginal birth or a C-section. I didn't say that very well, but I think you know what I mean. So the birthplace is so important, someplace where they have a low C-section rate, where they're willing, you know, to put the time and the effort in for women that want a VBAC. And then your caregiver is so important. In our area in Indy, we have so many options for midwives, and a lot of them can support VBAC in a hospital setting. And we have home birth midwives that support VBAC in a home setting. And midwives are a fabulous option for VBAC. but there are supportive OBs as well. And so it's just really important that that caregiver and birthplace that you choose wisely, and that you're willing to make a change later if you find out they're not supportive, no matter how late it is. I've had people change, right away, and I've had people change later on in their, even late in their pregnancy, like 38, 39 weeks, believe it or not. So the third thing is to get a doula. And when I say that to people, I always say it doesn't even matter if it's me, because a doula increases your odds of having a vaginal birth. And a doula that's educated in VBAC is good, but honestly, a doula is important because you have that one-on-one support. The fourth thing is to go into labor on your own to avoid induction. And ACOG says an induction can be acceptable for VBAC, and it can be. I've had clients have inductions and have great vaginal births, but planning to go into labor on your own, unless there's a medical indication, is the best way to be successful with a VBAC, because when you go into labor on your own, obviously your body is ready and prepared, and all the hormonal soup that's going on that needs to happen for you to have a great labor is there. And so we want to use that if we can. And then the fifth thing is either to avoid or delay the epidural or pain medicine. And I think, I work with people that are all over the map as far as, they are absolutely no epidural no matter what, or people that I really, really want one. And that's okay. All of those things are fine, but I want to educate people about using an epidural as a tool. An epidural to me is like a great big hammer. It's not the first tool you pull out. It's for down the road when you really need it, if you really need it. And if you can avoid it, you can stay active, you can stay moving, you can use positioning easier, and you're more likely to be able to push your baby out when you can feel that urge to push. Or delaying the epidural until you're in active labor, and then having a light and late dose. So as late as possible and as light as possible. So the ideal for someone who wants an epidural, in my opinion, is they can move their legs, they can move themselves in bed, they can get on their knees, they can probably even squat with some help, but they're not in pain. However, they can still feel that they're having contractions. And when they're pushing, they can feel the pressure. Sometimes they can feel when to push. So what I always tell people is, with an epidural, you may feel when to push, but you don't feel how to push. Without an epidural, you feel when and how to push because of that urge. And so you're losing one of your benefits when you're numb. And so I'm real open about that, but I also tell people I'm going to support you in what you need.
How do I have a VBAC? This is a question I get asked a lot. Women will message me and say, I know I want to have a VBAC, but I have no idea how to prepare or how to find the resources. Well, that's exactly why I created my first steps to VBAC guide. It's called Preparing for a VBAC, your first three steps to an empowered birth experience. This is the guide you need if you're thinking, I don't know how to go about finding a supportive provider, or I'm not sure how to understand or process my C-section experience. If you have had questions about these things and you're wondering if you're on the right track, then you need to download this guide. I want you to go to ebbandflowbirthco.com/first steps, all one word, FIRSTSTEPS, or click the link where you're listening to this episode now. I know that getting started with VBAC prep and finding support is something a lot of women are struggling with. And I want you to have a solid foundation for your VBAC prep journey because it doesn't have to be such a stressful process. So again, go to ebbandflowbirthco.com/first steps to grab this free guide today. Okay, so now let's go into talking about induction. There has been an uptick in the amount and the rate of inductions, especially that people have been seeing as doulas supporting our clients. So, what do you feel like is going on with the increase, and do you think there's anything that can be done about it?
That's a great question. And I tell you what, my biggest thing I talk to, most important thing I talk to about women, I feel like is avoiding induction. I want to address it head on from the beginning because I know they're going to hear about it. And I think, talking about it and the reasons to avoid it and the reasons for it really makes a difference. But in my career, again, as I was getting my stats together, I was thinking about some of these things. Excuse me. And in the early 2000s, 2007, actually, the Healthy Babies, the March of Dimes brought out a campaign that healthy babies are worth the wait. And it was wait till 40 weeks. And March of Dimes, important organization with great name recognition. And they were talking about the benefits of waiting. And AWON, the Nurses Association, also tagged onto this. And they had posters all over hospitals and information out to care providers about waiting for 40 weeks, getting your full 40 weeks. So what was it like before that? Boy, I was seeing induction before that. And I had actually a friend sometime in the early 2000s who she went into her doctor at 37 weeks. She complained, I'm uncomfortable and I'm tired of being pregnant. And she said, you're 37 weeks. We can induce any time because nothing happens after 37 weeks. And that what they found in research is that incredible brain growth happens after 37 weeks, and the babies put on extra fat that they need for those first few weeks when they're learning how to breastfeed, and a number of other things happen. But when this Healthy Babies Are Worth the Wait campaign came out, it was a big deal because doctors started paying attention to it. And so that was 2007. In 2009, ACOG came out with an induction statement, and they said that induction should be avoided before 39 weeks without medical indication. That was a huge deal because people were inducing at 36, 37, 38 weeks for no reason except convenience. Sometimes, there were medical reasons, but sometimes it was just convenience. And babies, sometimes we're not exactly accurate on due dates. So sometimes babies are ending up in NICUs with respiratory distress because they were induced at 37 weeks and maybe they were only 35 weeks, And so it was a terrible situation. So anyway, things started to turn around after the ACOG message got out there. And so when I first started keeping stats about induction was 2009. So that's when I started to really think about it. And here were my rates during that decade: 10%, 16, 12, 4, 13, 11, 9. And so, they were right around that 10% range, which again is still a lot, but but less. And then after that, the ARRIVE trial came out in 2018. And what the ARRIVE trial said basically is that inducing all women at 39 weeks would induce, would, I'm sorry, would in decrease the rate of C-section from 19% to 20, from 22% to 19%. 3%. So, 3% is still 3%, but there's a lot of discussion about how that study was done. How the expectant management was carried out. And, I won't go into all of that because I can't speak super intelligently about it. But I know that a lot of people that know more than me have a lot of questions about that study. Well, that came out in 2018. And then doctors were back on the induction bus. And they were like, well, we shouldn't induce before 39 weeks. But at 39 weeks, let's induce everybody. They started offering inductions to everyone, even without medical need. And so, what did my rates see? Well, I saw like 15% in 2018, 10% in 2019, 2020. Well, what happened in 2020? COVID.
COVID.
21%, 2021, 17%, 22, 25%, 23 this year, 39%. of my clients
Oh
this
my
year have been
gosh.
induced. Now it's a small number because it's I've only had less than 20 clients this year so far that
Yeah,
have
but
delivered, but still
in 2022, you said was 25%.
25%.
Oh my goodness.
And these are women that hire a doula that mostly want a natural birth, that are seeing doctors that are more natural birth oriented. And, some of them are definitely for medical reasons. And I really believe because of COVID, some of those medical reasons increased due to things, that we couldn't imagine, like having COVID or having the vaccine. I don't know the answers, but I know that things changed. Or people just got more worried about it, one or the other. But there's a new study out that came out just in March of this year, and it said, well, what did the ARRIVE trial really accomplish so far? 18, 19, 20, 22, 23. So 5 years, what has it accomplished? The induction rate has gone from 30.2% to 36.1%. So 5% more. C-section rates have gone from 27.9% to 27.3%. So that is
They haven't
0.6%.
changed.
And this is from Birth Journal, Volume 50, Issue 2. And the question is, does the ARRIVE trial merit changing obstetric practice? And ACOG and the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine and ACNM, which is the Academy of Certified Nurse Midwives, said basically the trial should not be widely accepted, but it is reasonable to offer it at 39 weeks, but it should not be universal. So because it's so common now to offer it at 39 weeks, so many women that don't know any different, especially first-time moms, they jump at the chance because they want the predictability of planning and how to manage their lives and their logistics and everything. So, when I do my prenatal education, I talk a ton about what is the difference between going into labor naturally and being induced. How does it look different? How does it feel different? What are the results? How are the results different? Excuse me. And so I think one thing I can do as a doula is educate people. I'm not trying to scare them about induction because I know some of them will actually need one, because they are necessary sometimes medically. But I want them to understand that it's not a choice to be taken lightly because they are giving up things when they choose induction. On the other hand, if someone needs an induction, I want to educate them about the most natural way we can approach induction and hopefully get back on that natural birth plan. And I've had some real success this year with women that really wanted a natural birth and needed an induction. And we ended up having a vaginal birth without an epidural, without Pitocin at the end. Maybe they had Pitocin to bump them into labor, but then we were able to get it off and let them progress naturally. And they were so happy with that because they used what they needed of the technology, but then they let their body do it. So I think education is a big thing. I think we can educate our clients, but we can also talk about it in our circles of friends. For the people that don't have doulas, that aren't getting this information, that aren't taking childbirth classes, because I don't know what the numbers are, but the amount of people taking childbirth classes is minuscule.
Which is so, that's so weird to me. I mean, not all childbirth classes are created equal. I mean,
No.
the ones at the hospital, which is what I took the first time, very subpar. But I just, you would think that you would want to be educated on such a big life process,
I know.
and knowing your options and not just going into it blind. But obviously, we're not seeing that, unfortunately. I think knowing your options ahead of time really just helps the whole process.
And I think a lot of 20-somethings really have grown up in the internet age and they believe they can educate themselves that they don't need it. And if they are pointed the right direction, they might be able to educate themselves.
Right.
But they might not.
And there's so many, but there's so many online birth classes now that, I mean, anyone can take and they're affordable. No, they're not super cheap like hospital birth classes, but even some hospital birth classes are expensive. So there's so many different ways to educate yourself, and it all depends on the type of birth you're wanting too. So, like, I took HypnoBabies for the VBAC because I wanted to go unmedicated, and I knew my mindset was the thing I needed to work on. There's birth classes just for home birth. There's birth classes for C-sections. There's so many options.
And for instance, Sacred Roots, our birth center, they offer natural birth classes, and you don't have to be a patient there to take them. So, just that's a great option right there. That's an out-of-hospital option for natural birth. Because obviously, if you're going to deliver at a birth center, you are going to plan a natural birth.
Right.
But that's kind of a sad thing to me that the education really isn't out there. And so that's something I think in my future I might be thinking about is doing more education classes instead of just dual kinds to
Right.
kind of
And
increase that.
I think it's one, especially with the induction, is going more like in depth, like you said, about what all induction entails, because especially women who are more medical minded or and are fine with like birthing in the hospital, they may not realize that all of or really think about that all of these interventions, they have potential side effects. So you have to think about those. It's not just we're going to induce you and everything's going to be fine. Like everyone's body reacts differently, so there are potential side effects that are going to be involved with Pitocin or epidural or anything that you're going to be putting into your body, have those potential side effects that could lead to other complications. So just educating about those, not trying to scare them, like you said, but just knowing that there are potential side effects that have to be considered. That's why it can't be taken lightly and just a decision on a whim to do that.
When I taught doula training for 3 or 4 years, which was one of my favorite things to do, and we did a role play during that time that was called the Cascade of Interventions. And that's something that doulas talk about, but maybe parents don't know what that means. But what it means is one intervention leads to more interventions. And I made signs with yarn that went around that you would actually wear the sign. And the signs were kind of in order of interventions and then all the way from going into labor or induction all the way to C-section or vaginal birth. And we just threw everything in there. And then we assigned roles for people to play roles. And so we had the mother, we had the parent, we had the doctor, we had the nurse. Everybody had a role. And they didn't know what was happening in the game, but I did. So they had to make decisions. And we would give a card to the doctor, and the doctor would say, well, we need to do blah, blah, blah. And then they would make their decisions. And then we would give all the cards that went along with that decision, and they'd have to wear them. And I tell you, for doulas training, I think that was one of the most helpful things that we ever did in training because at the end, if they made all these intervention type decisions, they just had things hanging off them all over the place. Would they even end up with a vaginal birth? And so it was a really good exercise to kind of show, how those things played and how the decisions could change that. So it's a good memory anyway. excuse me.
And
Go
I was going
ahead.
to say, I just think that so obviously you're going to pre you can be presented with these options in the middle of labor and birth, but that's not the best time to educate yourself on the intervention that's about to happen. You want to do that ahead of time. So, because as we all know, if we've given birth, you're not in the right headspace to be thinking about the risks and benefits and all of that, especially if you're in active labor. So, knowing all that ahead of time and knowing that you have a good support team with you that's going to support what you want as far as your birth plan goes is really important.
And you bring up another really good thing of how important a birth plan is. And some people don't like birth plans. They don't They don't, some doulas don't. They don't want to encourage their clients to do that. I think birth plans are more accepted in the hospital settings than they've ever been. I mean, I've seen the difference and how things have changed. And in most places, birth plans are pretty respected, especially when you come in with a doula along with it. But I think the birth plan is so important because, first of all, it's a communication tool with, the birth team about what her priorities are, what her preferences are, how she wants to do this, how she wants to be treated, how she wants her environment to be, and all these things that are really important. Because, like you said, a woman in labor is not in the headspace to be able to make sure those things are happening generally. Once in a while, I have somebody who is, but not usually. So, if without a doula, the partner's really in charge of that, or the nurse, and a lot of nurses will be helpful, some more than others. But that birth plan really does help, at least to communicate what's important. And I encourage people to be flexible with that too, because we know that things can change. But the other thing I really encourage people is if things change, to plan B instead of plan A or to plan C, we can still preserve as much of the birth plan as we can from that point. And so it doesn't mean we're throwing it out the window and nothing's going to happen. It means that we have a change, we need to adapt, and we need to try to figure out how to keep things as normal as we can from this point. And I think that's a really important thing. And I think that women without a doula, they don't, they it's really hard to do that.
One thing I always talk about with women and clients and people that just ask me questions is it's not like it's, I learned this personally through my two birth experiences. When I started preparing for my VBAC, I thought, okay, VBAC is the end all be all. It's all about getting that vaginal birth. But then I realized it's not necessarily about the type of birth you have, whether it's C-section or VBAC or induction or how everything plays out. It's more that you have some say and you feel respected in what you want, and that you're making educated decisions about your birth and feeling empowered and respected in that versus something just happening to you that's out of your control. And obviously, we know that you can't control birth, but just knowing that you're educated on the decisions that you can make and you feel that you're respected, and I want this to happen in my birth, and regardless of how your birth actually ends up.
And that's so true. And Penny Simkin, who founded really the profession of doulas, and she founded DONA, her initial research showed that women remember their births, first of all, their whole lives, and that they see their birth as successful or good or memorable if they were listened to and supported. Exactly what you just said. And so, that as a doula, that's my role is to be there to support and to listen because I've had people have an experience completely opposite of what they went in for, but still in the end feel good about their experience. And that's the goal. That's, to have a healthy baby, a healthy mom, and a good experience. We can't control all the variables. But we can control how we treat the woman. And I think that makes a huge difference.
So what would you say are your top tips maybe for new doulas or even doulas that have been supporting births for years, but maybe struggling with the process of still supporting births? What would you say your top tips for doulas are?
Some of the things I was thinking about today was networking. Getting out there in the community and meeting people. It really makes a difference. Meet OBs, meet midwives, meet childbirth educators. Debrief your births with other doulas. That's so important and it's so helpful. So helpful to have a mentor doula. And this may be somebody that you actually attend births with or somebody that you just have to ask questions in a birth. And I have a couple people that text me, regularly when they're in a birth, asking questions and ideas. And some of us just text each other for support, like, okay, I've done this and this and this, and this is what's going on, because sometimes our brains get really stuck too. So having that hive mind out there to kind of help you, I think you really have to get experience. And get experience just means doing it over and over. If you're attending just a few births a year, you're not going to get very much experience, not going to get your name out there very much. Maybe that's all you can do at that point, but you need that experience. And if you can get it with another doula, which is kind of hard, and with COVID it was impossible, but it's beginning to be more possible again. That's awesome. Ask questions at births. Ask the midwife questions. Ask the OB questions. And I don't necessarily mean questioning what they're doing. I mean, when something that you haven't seen before or you don't understand. Not too long ago, I had a medication that was used that I had never heard of before, and I didn't know what it was for or how it worked. And I just said, "Hey, I've never heard of that. Could you tell me more about that? I just really want to understand it." And people like to be able to share usually. And so that's helpful. Sometimes I'll ask the nurses. Now, in my experience with my experience that I have, I find myself often I'm educating young nurses, because I'm running into nurses who maybe have never seen a natural birth. Nurses that really don't know how to support that. And that's okay, because I'm there, but I want them to learn for the next person that's in there. Sometimes I'm telling them what the rules are in their own hospital because they don't know.
Yeah, because they're
Yeah.
new and they don't have all the experience. Even though they're nurses and we're doulas, they still haven't seen as many births.
Right. Like at IU Riley, where you can have a water birth, there are nurses that come in that have never been in a water birth. So, I'm telling them, this is how we fill up this hub. This is the temperature. This is what works, because I have experience and I can tell them. I'm not, lording that over them or anything, but I want them to learn, because that's how I learned, by people telling me and showing me. And I want to be able to share that when I can. And they usually appreciate it. Once in a while, I get either a really young nurse or a really old nurse who feel threatened by a doula. And a really young nurse, what they tend to do is they stick by the rules. They're going to follow the rules to the letter. They don't know how to go outside of the rules safely, And sometimes the older nurses, they are so set in their ways that it's really hard to get them to do anything different than what they're used to. So that those things can be frustrating. But my other tip for doulas is, when you walk in the room, into the hospital room, especially in the hospital, you want to make that nurse your friend. You want her to be on this team that you're on. You want her to care about this woman, care about this birth. You want her to know how she's prepared, know what she's wanting, know what she's expecting. And you want to be friendly, And sometimes I'm so intense on the birth, because a lot of times we show up at, 7 or 8 centimeters. You're not really having conversations very well at that point. So sometimes it's hard to do that, but I really want to work at drawing everyone in, to that. And I want to make friends, and I want to create a team. I don't want to be an adversary. I don't want to create that tension. Sometimes there is tension, but I don't want it to be because of me.
And I completely agree, because especially in social media, birth work and social media, there's a lot of like, this is black and white, we're on different sides, it's doulas against the system type of thing. And I think in order to support our clients best, we really need to all be working together. And I know that there's a lot of hospitals and the medical system in general in the US is not extremely conducive to that all the time. But it is possible to go into it not being combative, and just we're all there to support the mother and the baby. So just being collaborative instead of competing against each other, and just knowing that we all have the same goal in mind. It's to support this birth. So it's really hard because there is a lot of birth trauma. There is a lot of medical abuse and obstetric abuse that happens, but and it's hard to witness that. And just in the few births that I've attended, I've already seen that. So just knowing, like you said, going into it, we're all a team here. We are not here to work against each other.
Absolutely. I would also say to newer doulas to educate yourself. You know, when you just when because you do your training doesn't mean that you're educated. You have to keep educating yourself. And you know, podcasts did not exist when I started. I'm a reader, so I read a lot of books, but there are so many podcasts out there, you know, that can help you learn. I've already mentioned the VBAC link, which is a great podcast, but I'll tell you that really the number one I think that we should be familiar with as doulas is evidence-based birth.
I love that podcast. Love it.
And almost any topic that you need information on, she's done a podcast or a fact sheet about it. And it's so valuable because it's so research-based. But once in a while, it's not even the message I want. Like it's not the conclusion I want, but I know it's research based. And so I, especially when I have clients that like research and that want that kind of thing, I'm going to send them that. And even just recently, I had a great result with that. And we were talking earlier about preventing that primary C-section. And so I think I'm going to end on this because it's such a great story. And the story's not over because the baby hasn't been born yet. But I have a client who was seeing an OB in a hospital. And at 20 weeks, her baby was measuring 95th percentile. At 20 weeks, the OB brought up planning a C-section.
At 20 weeks.
Yes. At 30 weeks, her baby was measuring 98th percentile, and her doctor was wanting to go ahead and schedule her C-section. Not a word about even induction.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, and I can understand if baby's really big and maybe, you know, you want to think about getting a baby born earlier. I get that. I do not get a first-time mom being scheduled for a C-section because of the size of baby.
I know, especially big babies are born vaginally, and not
Absolutely.
even mentioning induction, like you said, that's just completely skipping a step.
So when I first met with her, I was concerned about her practice. She was going to because I knew they were pretty intervention happy. And so I told her at the hospital you're going to, there is a practice of midwives. I just want you to know that in case you're interested in it. But I didn't want to be pushy, and she wasn't interested in it. And then after at 30 weeks, when they suggested scheduling the C-section, I said, I think it was 32 weeks when they were pushing her to actually pick a date. And she told me, and she was crying, and I said, "Are you ready to talk about midwives?" And she said, "Yes." And they had a negative connotation of midwives, that it wasn't the best care. That a doctor care was the better care, and that you wouldn't get it would be subnormal care to have a midwife, which we know is not the truth, but that's kind of what this couple thought having a first baby. And so she called the midwife practice. She made an appointment. They talked to her over the phone and said, "You know, we'd be glad to talk to you." She asked me to go with her for her first appointment. It was just a meet and greet. And at the end of it, she was broken down in tears because in 15 minutes, this midwife had given her everything that she wanted from her OB, which is there is no reason for you to not have a chance to have a vaginal birth. We would support you in that if you want to do that. And so she went home, talked to her husband, and they made the switch. And now they've had like two, she's 36 weeks. I think 36 or 37. And they have had two appointments with the midwives. And every time the husband, when the husband went, he's really proactive husband and very protective of her. And he was just thrilled. He was like, oh my gosh, it's night and day. But the other thing that was so odd is they had done ultrasounds after ultrasounds at her OB practice. They had never measured her fundus. And she didn't know that that's something that was supposed to happen. And when she went in and the midwife measured, she said, you're measuring right at 35 weeks, which is what she was at that point. And, you know, she said, you're doing fine. I wouldn't be surprised if you went right to your due date, you know, and all of this. And so she is carrying a big baby. It is a big baby. That doesn't mean she can't birth that baby. I really believe she's going to have every opportunity, and we just found out now that she's out from under that stress, the baby is in a perfect position. He was not before, and he is now. And she's getting chiropractic care. She's doing spinning babies exercises. She's seen the midwives. She's a few weeks away from her due date, and I feel like she's going to have every opportunity to go into labor and have a vaginal birth. I think had she stayed with the other practice, I feel almost 100% sure she would have had a C-section, even if she talked them into induction. And so that's what it means to make a difference. Now, I'm not tooting my horn. I'm just saying as doulas, we can really make a difference by letting our clients know that they have other options if things aren't the way they want them to be. And again, OBs can be very supportive, and it doesn't mean that an OB can't do that, but this OB was not doing it for her.
Especially if you bring up C-section at 20 weeks, that's all in their minds. Tunnel vision, C-section all the way is what they're thinking. And I don't know why they'd be doing so many ultrasounds
I
anyway.
know. And so, but now she's feeling confidence and she's feeling excitement, whereas before she was feeling fear and anxiety about her birth. That's her job. That's our job, is to help people find confidence, to lessen their fear, to increase their confidence and their excitement about their birth, and to be educated and willing to do the work. Because
I
we
can.
know it's work.
Yes, it's work. It's not just show up and do it. That's for sure.
Exactly. And so, you know, hopefully I can get back to you with the ending of that story.
Yes, I would love to hear how everything goes for her and her little baby. So, thank you, Julie, so much for being on the podcast today. For those of you that don't know, Julie was my doula for my VBAC last year with my daughter, and I have kept in contact with her obviously since as somewhat of a mentor, and we have a really close, somewhat close-knit community here of doulas in Indy, that help support each other, especially with education and backups and all of that. So thank you so much for sharing all that information and your story. I appreciate you being here.
Well, you're welcome, and thanks for inviting me. I absolutely enjoyed it so much. And you're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you.
Keep it
Thank
up.
you. Oh, I will. I'm keeping it going as long as I can.
Awesome. Good night.
Right. Bye, Julie.
Bye-bye.
You just finished another episode of the Ebb and Flow Birth Show. For more, head over to ebbandflowbirthco.com or on Instagram at ebbandflowbirthco. As a reminder, this podcast is provided to you for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not a substitute for medical advice. Until next time, bye, friends.